This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Clinton's new memoir, My Life, broke the record for first-day sales of a nonfiction book. The record was previously held by his wife, Hillary. Yesterday, I recorded an interview with the former president. He spoke to me from his home in Chappaqua, New York. I asked him first about the so-called culture war, dividing America over values, lifestyle, and religion. Even during his presidential campaign, Bill Clinton seemed to be at the center of that war, questioned about smoking marijuana, avoiding the draft, and marital infidelity. The country remains divided over how to interpret his behavior and his explanations, and divided over the impact of his private life on his legacy as president.
Why do you think you were such a lightning rod for the culture wars, even before Monica Lewinsky?
Because I tried to bridge the cultural divide, and I won in 92. And the Republicans had won in every presidential election since 1968 by essentially making the Democrats culturally unacceptable to white married Protestant voters. And they just sort of defined them out of the range of acceptability. If you look at the 88 presidential race where Mike Dukakis was ahead based on his record as governor of Massachusetts, but when they got through talking about the Pledge of Allegiance and Willie Horton, he was an unacceptable president to the cultural conservatives in America. And what I tried to do, because I was a white Southern Baptist who had been in the progressive tradition of my state and my region, I knew how to talk to people who were NRA members and who were pro-life but interested in other issues. I knew how to relate to that, and I had great respect for the values of faith and family. And I think it made the it drove the people on the other side who represented these conservative units and who thought they had a permanent lock on the presidency. They felt that President Carter only got elected because of the problems of Watergate. And when I won, it just infuriated them. They thought it was like it had interrupted the natural order of things. And then when I won re-election, it made them even madder.
You write in your book that one of the reasons why you think your critics hated you was, quote, because I was an apostate, a white Southern Protestant, who could appeal to the very people they had always taken for granted.
I agree with that. I think that's true. I had an enormous amount of respect for the sort of mainstream American, hardworking, conservative, middle-class people. And I knew where they came from. I knew how they thought. And I knew how, from my childhood, they had been manipulated over issues of race, and I thought they were now being manipulated over other issues. And I thought I could break through that, that I could bring people together, that I could build a broad national consensus on a new role for government in the post-Cold War, post-industrial era. We were in an interdependent global information age, and I thought that I could articulate a role for government that would be both pro-business and pro-labor, pro-work and pro-family, pro-growth and pro-environment, and that would respect traditional values and still accommodate all our diversity. And because I tried to put things together and it seemed to be working and it seemed to have appeal, I think it provoked a great reaction on the right. And I think one of the reasons that they attacked me personally so much is that they thought it might be the only strategy that would work, that, you know, if they had to fight over whether my ideas were better and whether my policies were working, that was a dead-bang loser for them. So their only politically acceptable strategy was to convince people I was no good.
President Clinton, in your book you write, "I believed my personal flaws, no matter how deep, were far less threatening to our democratic government than the power lust of my accusers." Had you been forced out of office, had the Senate voted to remove you from office, how do you think it would have affected the institution of the presidency?
Oh, I think it would have been forever weakened, because it would have basically been the case after that that there was no definition of impeachment. Impeachment was just a political process, and whenever one party had enough votes in Congress to terrorize and go after somebody, they could do it. That is, there was no substantial support among constitutional scholars, legal authorities, or prosecutors for the idea that the terrible personal mistake I made was either a prosecutable offense, much less an impeachable offense. There were hundreds and hundreds of people, historians and legal scholars, who were, many of whom were Republicans, who did not vote for me, who signed ads and letters saying that this is ridiculous, it's a threat to the Constitution. And it would have forever changed America, because America was founded by imperfect people. Thomas Jefferson, we now know, was an imperfect man. Alexander Hamilton, our first and great Secretary of the Treasury, was an imperfect man. They were not perfect people. And they understood that the greatest danger to free people was not just the absence of majority rule, but the absence of minority rights and limitations on government. Our Constitution is a fine balance of majority rule, minority rights, and limitations on government power. The Republican majority in Congress and their supporters in these interest groups and think tanks sought to take all the limits off their exercise of power. And to be fair to them, they believe they're good people with the right values and no one else should be in power, so it logically follows to them that they should concentrate as much power in their hands as possible. But that was the big fight we were having. That was the huge historic constitutional issue, and why it was so important that I stand in there and fight them.
So you've talked a little bit about how you think an impeachment would have affected the institution of the presidency. How do you think your personal behavior in the White House, the personal scandal, affected the institution of the presidency?
I think it hurt, and it hurt, but I think it's important. I have a better feeling for it now that I signed 4,000 books yesterday.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these people came up and talked to me. So I have a better feeling for it. I think that it hurt me because it gave ammunition. It hurt the presidency, and it hurt my fellow Americans because I did something I shouldn't have done, and because I did it under circumstances that no president had ever been compelled to live under. But a lot of people came up to me yesterday and said, you know, you made a bad mistake, but it was a private one, and it was nobody else's business, and you shouldn't have been subject to that kind of publicity. And the only reason I was is that the Whitewater investigation was carried on years beyond when it should have been shut down. And the Jones lawsuit was bogus, and even a Republican judge said there was nothing to that. And Kenneth Starr used his bogus Whitewater investigation to get into the bogus Jones lawsuit to go after me in a deposition. I mean, that's basically how this came out. So I think that I certainly think that what I did was wrong, gave ammunition to my enemies, and hurt the presidency and my country. But I also think it's important to recognize that it occurred under the most bizarre circumstances under which any president has ever been required to conduct his office. A 7-year, totally unwarranted, totally phony investigation where $70 million of the taxpayers' money was spent indicting innocent people because they refused to lie about me. So I think you have to, I don't spare myself in this book. I say everything I think I did wrong, both not just personal, but also public mistakes, my mistakes as president. But I think in the scale of things, against the measure of American history, this manic pursuit of power and abuse of it was a far larger threat.
Once the Monica story did break, what do you think the appropriate punishment should have been? Or the appropriate way of dealing with it should have been?
Well, it had to be dealt because it broke in some public context. It had to be dealt in some way. Let's look at what happened with Newt Gingrich. I mean, that's interesting. Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House. He was found to have been not dishonest in his responses under oath to the House, and perhaps to have violated the tax laws in what he did. There's a big public hearing on it. They didn't even censure him. They reprimanded him and gave him a fine. And there were serious legal issues involved there and indisputable conflicts between what he said and what the facts were. So I think that, you know, I should have been treated the same way he was. That's why I said in the book, I'm actually quite proud of the fact that I fought impeachment and defeated it, and I stood up to it and I didn't resign because they had been abusing their power long before I made my personal mistake. I'm not proud of my personal mistake, and I've done my best to atone for it and to apologize to everybody concerned, but it pales in comparison to what they did as a threat to our democracy and our way of life, and that's what I believe.
My guest is former President Bill Clinton. His memoir, My Life, was published this week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded yesterday with Bill Clinton. His memoir, My Life, was published this week. until September 11th, most Americans weren't really paying much attention to bin Laden. And even like the bombing of the Cole, the embassy bombings, they were far away. They weren't the kind of personal threat to people that al-Qaeda became after September 11th. So you were dealing with an enemy that you thought was really quite dangerous to America, but wasn't really in the public mind yet. And I'm wondering if that affected the strategy at all of how to deal with him. And I'd also be interested in hearing about your thinking about how much to publicly discuss bin Laden, how much to kind of put him on the map to make Americans aware of him, and how much to just kind of like work behind the scenes and deal with him more quietly.
Well, let me say, first of all, I started trying to talk about this early in my first term. I sent anti-terrorism legislation up to the Hill to try to strengthen our ability to deal with terrorism before the Oklahoma City bombing in April of 95. Then after that, I proposed strengthening amendments to it, and a year later it passed. In 1996, I gave a major speech at George Washington University saying that terrorism was a great threat of our generation. And you know, of course, after the African embassy bombings, we bombed the camps. But all along through here, we had terrorist incidents, the first World Trade Center bombing, the killings at the CIA. We arrested people. We brought them to justice. We prevented attacks on the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the UN building, the Los Angeles airport, planes flying from the Philippines to LA. We broke up 20 al-Qaeda cells. All this was going on while this was, you know, during my presidency, because we knew what a big problem terrorism was in general, and bin Laden and al-Qaeda specifically. They were, in the beginning, we thought bin Laden, the intelligence people did, thought he was basically a financier of terrorism. And then it became clear that he had his own operation, and then it became quite clear that they were involved directly or indirectly in a lot of the things we'd already stopped or dealt with, and that he was by far the most formidable force in the world. And so I was really, you know, concerned about it. And it was interesting. After 9/11, one of the, I won't embarrass him by saying who it is, but one of the network news anchors called me on the telephone and said, you know, this is, you were talking about this for years and nobody paid any attention, I guess because it never happened here. But I tried to get people interested in this, that, and maybe I should have done more, but here's the problem. I don't know that by talking about it more and scaring people more, I could have affected the defenses of the country. That is, we were having, for example, before the millennium, for a couple months before the millennium, several times a week we had meetings in the National Security room at the White House, the secure room, with the FBI, the CIA, all the other intelligence people, trying to prevent these planned attacks in the millennium. And with good planning, good work, and a little bit of luck, we were able to prevent a number of planned attacks in the United States and in the Middle East. But the trick is to inform people about what the problem is, to talk about it, without unnecessarily terrifying people for no good end. You know, maybe the 9/11 Commission will have a judgment on that. Maybe they'll say I should have said more or done more, but I thought I said as much as I could, consistent with not revealing intelligence sources and not just trying to terrify the American people for no good reason in a way that wouldn't provoke any positive action.
You were unhappy with the performance of FBI Director Louis Freeh. Security experts in your administration were complaining that the FBI wasn't sharing information. You weren't getting along with him. And at the same time, the FBI was part of the investigation into your life. Would you have, you appointed him. FBI directors usually serve a 10-year term. Would you have fired him if not for the fact that it could have looked like you were attacking him because of the investigation into your life?
Well, the answer to that is maybe. But I think the reason I didn't is slightly different from what you said. That is, I did not know that they were not sharing information until 9/11 happened. Keep in mind, in my first term, I signed an executive order requiring the CIA, excuse me, and the FBI to exchange high-level executives and to cooperate with each other more. No one ever told me that wasn't happening. When we had these intense planning sessions, as we did around the millennium, We always had a senior member of the FBI in the White House with the CIA and the National Security Team, and they worked very closely around the millennium. So I had, the FBI had a lot of problems. They falsely accused the guy in the Atlanta Olympic bombing. They messed up some forensic tests. They mishandled some of the computer systems they were supposed to put in. They lost some money in a drug case. There were a lot of problems there. And he decided at some point, he had been an active Republican before I appointed him, and I didn't care. See, I was more of a bipartisan guy. That's how naive I was. I didn't care. He had had a good record fighting organized crime as a U.S. attorney, and he'd been an FBI agent. So I appointed him on the recommendation of my counsel, and I wanted him to be a Republican. I wanted to put the FBI beyond politics, but he was getting hammered in the press and hammered by the Republicans in Congress, and he figured the best way to stop the hammering was to turn hostile toward the White House, particularly in the campaign finance investigation, where there wasn't a shred of evidence that we knew anything about any kind of improper fundraising. And so that's what he did. And I didn't like that, but since I knew I hadn't done anything wrong, and I knew we hadn't done anything wrong, I was far more concerned about the other problems in the FBI. And for those other reasons, I might have terminated him, but I decided it wasn't worth the effort because there would have been this uproar in the press that I did it only because he was after me. The fundamental problems, I think, with the FBI go back to the post-Watergate era where, because President Nixon and the White House abused the FBI, there was this idea that the White House and the FBI shouldn't even have direct contact. So it was very hard to know what was and wasn't going on. And I must say that I think one of the good things that have happened after the out of the terrible tragedy of 9/11 is that we now have Mr. Mueller in as the head of the FBI, who I appointed, U.S. Attorney from Northern California. He clearly talks to the White House all the time, and nobody thinks there's anything wrong with it because they ought to be talking to protect the national security of the country. So I think we're in a good place now. But that's basically the history. I have no evidence the FBI did not work with us closely when we were forcing cooperation, like up to the millennium. I did not know they were not sharing information. Had I known it would have made a big difference.
Are you haunted by any missed opportunities in your fight against terrorism and your fight to get bin Laden?
Well, I wish he'd been where we thought he was when we bombed him.
Right.
And the other thing is that I'm really haunted by is something I don't think I could have done anything about. I was more than prepared to take military action against Afghanistan and bin Laden after the USS Cole.
You're talking about October 2000.
Yes, and I believe we could have gotten UN support to do it if, but only if, the FBI and the CIA had agreed that bin Laden was responsible. Nearly everybody was sure that they were from the minute it happened. But for reasons I don't entirely understand, the FBI and the CIA did not formally agree that he was responsible until after I left office. So I was reluctant to launch an invasion of Afghanistan or send in large numbers of special forces by parachute drop without, you know, the CIA and the FBI saying that he did. Because we had, to be fair, other cases where we found out somebody was responsible who wasn't. I mean, if you look at the Olympic pipe bomber, one person was fingered, identified, and virtually ruined. It turned out somebody else did it. If you look at Oklahoma City, where Timothy McVeigh did it for a day until he was picked up by an alert Oklahoma lawman, everybody assumed it was a Middle East terrorist incident. So that's the thing that haunts me most. I'd give anything that if there'd been a late October identification, a formal finding by the FBI and the CIA that bin Laden had done it, then I could have taken action with November, December, and January left in my term, free to do it and not being part of the political environment. Or even if it happened after the election, I would have felt perfectly free to do it. That's about the only thing I can think of. I know of no other thing that we could have done to prevent something from happening or in response to something that happened. I was extremely frustrated that I thought we were going to have three other attacks that were called off at the last minute because the CIA said the intelligence wasn't good enough to justify it. But I don't see that as a missed opportunity. I don't know that there's anything I could have done about that.
On September 11th, when you found out about the planes hitting the World Trade Center, did you immediately think bin Laden?
Mm-hmm. I was on the phone, actually, when the second I was in Australia, and two of my former staff members, Bruce Lindsay and Cheryl Mills, were in Lower Manhattan, and they called and basically talked me through the second plane hitting the second tower. And the minute they said what had happened, I said, Bin Laden did this. And they said, how do you know? I said, because there are only about two, maybe three intelligence networks in the world, terrorist network, capable of doing it, and the others are all too identified with nations, and we could retaliate and hurt them much worse than they have just hurt us. So, but Bin Laden lives in a cave in Afghanistan, and they have a global network, and they're really, you know, they're extremely clever, adroit, and well-financed. I knew immediately he'd done it.
We'll hear more of our interview with Bill Clinton in the second half of the show. His memoir, My Life, was published this week. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview I recorded yesterday with former President Bill Clinton. His new memoir, My Life, was published this week.
One of the accomplishments that you were most proud of upon leaving office was the budget surplus that the country had when your administration ended. How had you hoped that surplus would be used?
Well, I hoped it would be used in a couple of ways. First of all, I knew that sooner or later we'd have a recession of some duration, and I thought it would cushion it. And because when you have recessions, typically you have to run a deficit because you have less tax money coming in and more tax money going out the door. I hope that the surplus would be used to pay down the national debt and that the interest savings on the national debt would be put in the Social Security Trust Fund so that Social Security would be good throughout the life of the baby boom generation. So even with this, with the economic slowdown, if we hadn't had these massive tax cuts, we would be closer to a balanced budget now. And the American people don't yet feel the burden of these deficits we're running, because the economy hasn't fully recovered, because there's not that much demand for money, because the economy of the world hasn't fully recovered, and because the Chinese and the Japanese governments are loaning us this money at low interest rates to pay for the deficits and my tax cut. But I just strongly disagree with the 2001 tax cut was adopted before America knew what our income, our expenses, or our emergencies were going to be. It was unheard of. We adopted a huge tax cut without a budget. We didn't know what our projected revenues were. We didn't know how much money we had to spend. We had no idea of an emergency, which occurred on September the 11th. The fiscal year of the government ends on the last day of September. If we had done this in the normal way, we would never have adopted a tax cut until the end of the fiscal year, and then we would have known we had an emergency and we couldn't afford it. So it was a terrible mistake. Then we turned around in 2003 and did it all over again. And to make matters worse, we gave half the money to the top 1% and an extraordinary amount of the money to the 200,000 Americans like me who paid income taxes on over $1 million last year. And I just think it's wrong. I think it is so wrong. We've got National Guards people over there fighting in Iraq, and the administration doesn't even want to make them eligible for military health care benefits if they're not covered by their own health care plans. We've increased the cost of veterans benefits at health centers by 500%. We've cut 300,000 kids out of their after-school programs, and I still got my tax cut. That's my sacrifice in the war on terror. I think it is bad ethics and terrible economics. I think, and it's something we're going to have to pay for a long time to come. And so that's what I believe.
Just, I'm wondering personally how you feel watching the surplus that you left the country with now turn into a huge multi-billion dollar deficit.
In the short run, I didn't mind having a short-term deficit, because no economic expansion lasts forever without adjustment. If the president had said, and 9/11, by the way, caused a psychological problem which depressed the economy. So the president had come to the American people and said, I want to have a 2-year or a 3-year temporary tax cut to stimulate the economy. And if it had been bigger than the tax cut he offered in the first 2 or 3 years, and then it had gone away, I would have actually supported that to try to get the economy going again. But what would have happened is we would have immediately gone back to running our balance budgets and our surplus, paying down the debt, resuming the normal course that the country was on when I left office. But instead, we adopted these tax cuts that are phased in, that are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger just when they shouldn't, when the economy picks up again. And we're going to be paying for this forever. We're going to be right back where we were in the 1980s. And so it made me feel terrible, because what I tried to do was to leave my generation, the baby boom generation, with the security of knowing that their children were not going to have to support them instead of their grandchildren. And it's a huge, was a huge kind of economic gift to the next generation of Americans. And now we've thrown all of that away on what I consider to be highly self-indulgent tax cuts for upper-income people. I think it's selfish, and I think it's wrong. And we should have targeted these tax cuts to middle-class people and small businesses. They could have even been bigger. Some of the middle-class tax cuts and family tax cuts, and I would have liked to have seen an expansion in the earned income tax credit for lower-income working people. They could have been permanent. But most of this stuff is just wrong. It's just bad economics. It's personally selfish for really wealthy people to have this kind of money. I know no millionaire in New York, and I know a lot of them, Republican or Democrats, who believes this is right. I don't know anybody who believes it's right. Now, I'm sure there are some ideological people out there who believe it's right, but I don't know anybody that does. I live in New York and I work in Harlem. And I go down the street every day and I look at all these kids and I hope they're getting a good education. This year's budget has kicked 300,000 children, poor children, out of their after-school programs to leave my tax cut intact. The budget that the Congress is dealing with now proposes to kick another 1.3 million children out of their after-school programs to leave my tax cut intact, to kick 88,000 uniformed police off the street, and does not do what the Democrats want to do, which is to double the number of containers we're checking at ports and airports for chemical and biological weapons, all of because it would require some alteration in my tax cut. And I don't know anybody in my income range who wouldn't be happy to have a smaller tax cut or none at all to keep the kids in after-school programs, the cops on the street, and keep 300 million Americans safer from containers loaded with biological and chemical agents. I just think it's wrong. It's just wrong.
President Clinton, a question about the Middle East. Middle East peace was always an important issue during your presidency, and you spent a good deal of the – you spent a lot of time in the final days of your presidency trying to negotiate a new Middle East peace plan. You write in your book, "At the time, Arafat seemed confused, not wholly in command of the facts. I had felt for some time that he might not be at the top of his game." What exactly were you picking up about him? What were you noticing? And is it something that you felt at the time you should talk publicly about, or did you think it was best left not mentioned?
Oh, no, because at the time he also was promising me every time I talked to him that we were going to make peace. You know, he begged me not to go to North Korea and end their missile program because he said I would have to be there to close the deal. It was not clear to me, even in December, that in the end he wouldn't finally make the peace deal before I left office.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause what I meant to say was, keep in mind, Arafat had survived a huge number of assassination attempts, a plane crash. He spent the night in a different place every night for 20 years. He lived on an airplane flying all over the world. And what I felt was, and he was never kind of a linear thinker in the way that, you know, this interview is that you're having with me, it goes from A to B to C, you know, but not everybody thinks that way. It was okay. Arafat was always really smart, but he tended to hit the high points and think about the direction things were going in. And sometimes I felt things were lost in the translation. And along toward the end of my service, I felt like that the details were being lost more than they had been earlier, and that might make him more vulnerable to having somebody reduce his willingness to take a tough decision because he might be criticized for it. Because if you go back and read the whole book, I also say Arafat did a good job, and so did Mr. Netanyahu at Y River. I mean, here they were from dramatically opposite political poles. They got together. They stayed there 9 days. They made a very tough set of decisions, which kept the peace process alive. So I had no reason to believe, after Arafat had done that, as well as signing the original peace agreement, that he didn't mean it in 2000 when he said he was absolutely going to sign a final peace deal. And I just think something spooked him out of it, And I think it had something to do with the fact that he was getting older and probably did not carry around in his own mind as many of the details and the sort of general concept of what we were trying to do as he earlier had. He's not, I didn't mean to imply that I thought he had early Alzheimer's or anything like that. I just had the feeling that he didn't have as much confidence about the details at the end as he had earlier in the process.
My guest is Bill Clinton. His memoir, My Life, was published this week. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview I recorded yesterday with Bill Clinton. His memoir, My Life, was published this week.
President Clinton, I think your new book is the first presidential memoir to deal with subjects in such depth on a personal level, things like the sex scandal, the state of your marriage, the fact that your stepfather had beaten your mother. Do you think that that degree of personal information from a president is a good thing in that it helps us understand who the person is, it helps us understand the real vulnerabilities of a president, or do you think it's a bad thing in that it takes away from the aura of the office? Maybe America doesn't want to know about the real vulnerabilities of a president.
I have mixed feelings about it. I did it because I had no choice in that sense.
In which sense? Because so much was already out?
because from the time I started running for president, I was subject to intense personal attacks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so much had been said about me that wasn't true. The stuff that as bad as some of the things I had to talk about are, that they pale in comparison to the things that I was regularly accused of from the time I ran for president on. So, I don't approve of that. At that level, I don't think, the state of a president's marriage in some level is anybody's business any more than the state of anybody else's marriage is. But, and nor do I think anybody, any human being should be defined by his or her worst moment. I just think that's silly too, unless it's, a mass murder or, some other crime. I just think it's wrong. But we live in a time when that's the way a lot of my presidency unfolded to people in the press and because of my political opponents. And if you notice in the book, I didn't do that to them. There were all kinds of personal issues which came up about the Republicans that were tormenting me, and I didn't deal with any of that in the book.
What do you mean tormenting you? You mean that you knew about indiscretions on the part of your opponents?
And they were reported at the time. The press finally began to report a little on them, I think, just out of being shamefaced and because there was an attempt to bring it out, but I didn't mention any of that in my book because I don't think it is legitimate. On the other hand, let me say that there's two ways to look at politics. That most politicians and parties historically preferred to engage in myth-making. And so we make myths about people while they're alive, and then when they're dead, the details come out. That's what happened to President Kennedy. Thomas Jefferson, when in my second term, we have a DNA test that said that Sally Hemings' children were his. But there, and a country does need its myths to a certain extent. On the other hand, I think in general, it's not good for a free people to engage in too much myth-making. That is, turning three-dimensional human beings into two-dimensional cartoon characters. Because then you wind up either deifying them are demonizing them. And in America now, most of the myth-making is done by the right. They try to deify all their characters, and they try to demonize everybody else. And the Democrats have not been very good at either one and basically are uncomfortable with both. So, and we're a big, mature country. We should know that our greatest political leaders were not perfect people.
Well, listen,
and they shouldn't have to be dead 100 years for us to figure that out. And I think it's better, and I personally think even a lot of our deified figures are more interesting when you know something about their warts. People have complicated lives. Nobody's got a perfect life.
Is that one of the things you've studied as a student of history? Have you studied previous presidents not only in their policy decisions, but examined their characters and their flaws?
Oh, sure. A lot. I've thought a lot about how Lincoln overcame his depression, for example. He'd have had a really hard time getting elected in today's environment because he had really chronic depression. As a young lawyer, he once was so depressed he didn't leave his house for a month. And yet, funny enough, when he became president, And his wife, who had been a sunnier sort of person, was ground down by the loss of their child, the loss of three of her half-brothers fighting for the Confederacy, being accused of being a spy, all the personal tragedy they had. It drove her to the brink of madness. All the personal tragedy that he suffered and all the blood that was flowing in the country, somehow he absorbed it and it made him greater. And he went beyond his own depression. It was amazing because from the time he was a very young man, he was in the grip of depression. And it was often just paralyzing. A lot of his friends wrote about it when he was young. When he became president, somehow by dealing with the grief of other people and the country at large, and even his own grief at the loss of his beloved son, he lost two sons, one before he got to be president, he overcame that. That's fascinating to me. It's fascinating to me to figure out how Roosevelt dealt with the humiliation of falling on his face when he tried to return to life after he got polio, and how he became a more serious person, and how he and his wife had a very complicated relationship. They loved each other very much. They had a bunch of kids, but they had big pockets of estrangement between them and pain, and they rendered enormous service to this country because they stuck with what they had in common. I mean, that's fascinating to me. I think knowing these people as people, to me, makes their public service greater and more meaningful.
So how much do you think we should know or want to know about a public figure's private life, about a president's private life while they're in office or as we're...
Not very much. Uh-huh. I think we want to know some things, but I don't think that the problem is, it either is a one-way street, the way it was when I was running, because with the Democrats didn't do it, and the mainstream press wouldn't report it unless somebody brought it to them and shoved it in their face. So since only one side was bringing it to them and shoving it in their face, it was a one-way street. So you can't possibly have a balanced view of that when that sort of thing happens. And it also is just, it's crazy to basically say, we're going to define everybody who's in politics by their worst moment, and every political career becomes a game of gotcha, and to have the press pretend that they're doing this for reasons of principle and morality when we know that's not true. We know it's not true because there's no even-handedness in the way these things are reported. I think that it's always going to be uneven and inconsistent, and it basically depends on who's willing to do it, who's got the basically just the sort of coarseness to do this kind of stuff. So it's never going to be fair, and therefore I don't think it lends itself to good judgment. And you also run a lot of good people out of politics. I mean, I just had an unusually high pain threshold, and I also could deal with the ongoing investigations, ironically, as I said in my book, because I had learned how to live what I call parallel lives.
Well, you know, I mean, I was really wondering, after something like the Star Report is published that was so explicit, how do you stand up in front of the world and make a State of the Union address? How do you just carry on?
Well, Mandela helped me a lot about that. I talked a lot about that in my book. But one of the things that really helped me was that all these world leaders, took the unusual step of coming to the United States and speaking up for me. I mean, Mandela came, Havel came, King Hussein was dying during the time we did the Y River thing, and everybody knew it. And he got up in front of the press corps and said he'd worked with 9 presidents, nobody done as much for peace in the Middle East, and he hoped I'd be around for a long, long time to do it. I mean, these kinds of statements are highly unusual when foreign leaders will weigh in there. So I looked at the people that were for me and the people that were against me, and I figured, however mad I was at myself, I couldn't be that bad a fellow if I had those enemies and those friends. I liked my friends and I liked my enemies. I'd never want to change them. So I also think there's something liberating about being publicly humiliated if you don't give people permission to break you. I can say anything about you that I want. I can say you're wonderful or you're terrible. But if I say it, it's because I need to say it, not because it's true, either way. And so part of becoming a whole person is not giving people permission to humiliate you. I just decided that you know, whatever was wrong with me, I was glad that I would never do what Ken Starr did. I was glad that I had never been that much in the grip of an obsession. I was glad I never wanted to hurt anybody like that. I was glad that I never wanted to destroy my political opponents that way. And I just said, you know, American people gave me a job. As long as they're for me, as long as Hillary and Chelsea want me to fight, as long as my staff and cabinet are loyal, as long as the Democrats in Congress are ready to go, I'm just going to suit up, go out there and go to work every day, and that's what I did.
Now that you are out of the White House, are you playing saxophone? Are you playing it any more than you were before?
You know, I set up a music room here at Chappaqua, and I played a little bit my first year, and then I got all wrapped up in writing the book. Now that the book is done,
yeah,
and as soon as the book tour is over, I'm going to start playing in earnest again, and I may even start taking some lessons, because I promised the Apollo Theater people I would try to help them raise some money to restore the Apollo in Harlem, and they have an amateur night there once a week, which is on cable television, where the crowd either claps or boos you off the stage, and if you don't go, they take a hook and hook you off. And if I go out there and play, I don't want to be hooked off. So I've got a long way to go to get my chops back. But I want to play again. I just couldn't do it while I was writing.
President Clinton, thank you so much for talking with us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bill Clinton spoke to us from his home in Chappaqua, New York. His memoir, My Life, was published this week.